Now, we have got a very special message coming up, but first, our theme music. Welcome. Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and I did promise you a special message.
I'm Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke, the 10th man to walk on the moon, and you got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. This is the Space Show, Australia, on 88.3 Southern FM.
Yes, and 50 years ago, we would have had a bunch of guys turning blue because they were waiting for the first Australian-built but second-launched satellite. Yes, 50 years ago, Australia put a Sabbath satellite into space, and it was built at Melbourne University, and we're going to be meeting in a few seconds those people. But first, let's listen to the sound of that satellite. Now, I warn you, this is something that not even the makers of the satellite would have enjoyed, let alone their mothers. But let's hear it anyway, because it is very historic. The sound of Australia's second satellite in space. Well, let's introduce our guests this evening, because they were the culprits in making that god-awful sound. Welcome, Richard Tonkin.
Good evening, Andrew.
And Peter Hammer.
Good evening, Andrew, and listeners as well.
Good. Now, what were we listening to there? Explain to us, please.
Mainly noise, I think.
a fair bit of static there, but buried in that static...
Buried in the static, there's the telemetry system, which started out with the Morse characters HI, which is did it, and then seven channels of audio telemetry, and then that sequence repeated.
Okay, well, let's listen to a longer version. But that was recorded on a frequency of 29 megahertz, and the next one is on 144 megahertz, and it's the beacon, I believe. So, Peter, what do these squawks and squeaks mean?
Well, the initial sequence was twice the characters HI, so that was the did. And after that, there were seven channels of audio telemetry, where the frequency of each channel varied depending on the parameter that you were measuring.
Richard, you got involved in this project. How did that happen?
Oh, well, Andrew, when I was at school at the age of 13 or 14, Sputnik was launched suddenly, and I was at boarding school and not having very much else to do. My classmates were taken up to the Shrine Hill in South Yarra, and told by the housemaster to look up in the sky the next night, and we'd see this faint star moving across the sky. And indeed, there it was, and I was hooked. Absolutely. I was fascinated by space, and it's a fascination that's continued all my life.
You didn't see Sputnik 1, though?
Sorry, this is a trick question. I saw the carrier rocket.
You saw the carrier
rocket. Yes, yes, thank you.
Yes, I remember being in the Cubs, and we were taken outside to see it. It was a partly cloudy day, and you know how the stars seem to be moving when the clouds are moving past?
Yeah, yeah.
And someone pointed up and said, there it is, this button. And I thought, that's just a star moving. So, no, I didn't see either Sputnik 1, which very few people saw, or the carrier rocket, which was a lot brighter and many people saw.
Yeah,
but anyway.
Right.
And I didn't see it at all because I was short-sighted and refused to wear glasses.
Okay, well, we have a story here prepared by the Melbourne Space Program, the people who put up a satellite only last year. And this is called The Improbable True Story of Australia's First Spacecraft. So let's go and listen to that.
It came up over the horizon. We're waiting and waiting, and suddenly it was there, it was working. Very few people know that a group of students built the first Australian satellite. Nobody knows that anymore because it's history, it's been forgotten. But we're all still here, and we think it's a story that's worth telling.
Russia's first satellite is world news. And in Australia, scientists and astronomers are on duty day and night, tracking its orbit as it hurtles round the globe, 560 miles up in space.
I was at boarding school, and the housemaster came and said, "Everyone, down tools, out onto the football ground." There it was, there was Sputnik coming across the sky, and that really intrigued me, and I wanted to become the expert in space.
The housemaster at my school said, if you look up in the sky over in that direction, you will see Sputnik. And we said, what do we see? He said, well, it'll look like a faint star moving across the sky quite quickly. And we looked up and there it was. And from that moment, I was hooked.
It was an interesting time to be growing up, fiddling around building things, playing with fireworks, creating fireworks, making rockets and firing rockets from 44-gallon drums. And I was going to a school which was a private school, and if you didn't play sport, you were an outcast.
They thought I was a bit weird.
An absolute nerd. But I arrived at the university, and there's a group of people who are equally enamoured, interested in space.
I found out that there were other people like me. There were other geeks, even if I was a geek, and this was wonderful.
And I don't know who suggested the idea, why don't we build a satellite? But we all sort of said, well, that sounds like a good idea, why don't we?
And some idiot, and it may well have been me, said, well, let's build a satellite. But we did.
People we talked to all scoffed at this and said this is ridiculous. No one's in Australia has ever built a satellite before. This was only a few years after Sputnik had been launched. We were 21 or 2 or something, and of course we could do it.
We absolutely had no idea what we were in for, absolutely none. But we realised it's all very well building a satellite, you do have to get it launched. So we wrote to the OSCAR project in the United States, they'd already launched 4, and said, if we build a satellite, will you launch it for us?
And they wrote back and said, if you build it, we'll try and get it launched.
So we thought, oh dear, well that's calling our bluff, isn't it?
That was all we needed. Of course, we went ahead immediately.
Well, this is a replica, which is now a museum piece. The antennas like these are just straight bits of carpenter's tape. Just ordinary nuts and bolts. There's nothing fancy about it. Inside, you've got electronics, which looks like this, hand-painted with nail varnish. And it was a matter of going around begging and borrowing to get things. Testing the transmitters were done out in somebody's backyard, and because we couldn't read the meters from as far away as we were, he used a rifle with a telescopic sight to read the meters. So it was very, very agricultural.
It turned out that our choices were quite unique, had never been done before, and so the satellite, Australis Oscar 5, ended up with quite a number of firsts.
Well, it was all built, it all fitted together, and it all worked.
The era, we were going through tremendous change from the 50s to the 60s. It was just mind-boggling. Free love, we didn't have any boundaries. Yeah, I don't think they knew anything about women, actually. I think they were just starting to learn about that when I met up with first Richard and then Rowan. Yes, I could not compete with the satellite. She was their mistress, and you just have to give in after a while. We would sit down every night and watch the slaughter that was going on in Vietnam. You saw the napalm and the aftermath, and it was horrific. Owen's marble was pulled out of the barrel, and if your marble came out, then you had to go and do national service, and obviously that meant going to Vietnam. He had asthma, and he was allergic to beer, which sounds very improbable. So the night before his medical, we lined up all this beer. And so he wasn't a very well boy the next day when he went for his medical.
Yes. You deny it now, but you ruffled my hair and said, "Hello, what's your name? You're cute."
He said, "Well, I'd like you to come around and cook dinner for us one night." And I said, "Well, okay, I don't mind. I don't mind cooking. I'll come and cook dinner for you." And I was going to cook a roast. So I've done all the vegetables, I've got the roast ready to go in, and I look over at the oven, and I open the oven, and what's that in the oven? Bits of metal. And I don't know what, and then this person materialises behind me with Buddy Holly glasses, and he says, "Don't touch that! That's my satellite!"
Well, once it was built, three of us took it over to California in June 1967. We were treated like celebrities.
It was an utterly amazing experience. We saw things that few Americans would see. We saw Apollo command modules being made, including the first manned one.
We were taken to the Surveyor assembly line, and I said to one of the engineers there, "Could I touch it?" And he said, "Yes, put this glove on and you can touch it if you really want to." Some months later, Surveyor 2 was launched, and about 5 minutes before it was to land on the moon, and it exploded. And I often wondered whether my touch may have had something to do with it.
After we got back from the United States, we were sitting congratulating ourselves in our little cubby house in the physics building. And a telephone call. I just happened to be close to the phone, picked it up, and there was this very nervous woman, said she was from Weapons Research Establishment. "Could we please tell her about our satellite?" "Yes, yeah, fine." I told her, answered all the questions. What did we have to hide? It was perfectly open and public. The very next day, RESAT was announced.
Australia joined the Space Club of Nations by successfully launching on the 29th of November 1967 an Earth satellite of its own making. The project was an effort of the Weapons Research Establishment.
A bit annoyed about RESAT, because that was really, we really beat them to it.
They built that because they didn't want a bunch of uni students being first to launch a satellite. So that's the conspiracy theory, and let's just continue it. Why not?
When we left America, we thought that the Americans would arrange a launch with the Air Force, a launch which we thought would probably happen before the end of 1967. But it didn't, and we even thought we'd just get them to send it back and we'd put it in a museum somewhere, because there was no other way we thought we could get a launch.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
NASA was busy. It was. There was the minor question of putting a man on the moon.
I'm 21 years old. I was already in NASA. So these Australian students had built this scientific educational satellite and didn't have a way to get it launched. So in America, we thought we could get it launched, and so we tried.
And there was a young engineer working on their unmanned satellite launching rocket, Jan King. And Jan was the leader of the group that went to NASA and said, look, we think we've found a spot on the at the back of the second stage of the Delta rocket where we can fit this satellite in, and it could be launched that way. They said something along the lines of no, definitely no, and never.
No, hell no, and never. I don't think there was any serious expectation on those young engineers' parts that they would become part of the space program.
Jan and his group persisted. He persuaded NASA that it would be a great international relations exercise to NASA would launch this amateur-built satellite from a foreign country.
It just so happened that I was very fortunate to be in the right place at the right time, and that sort of continues on in this story. Ultimately, there was an awful lot of luck in all of this, that this all came to pass.
This is AX3WI with the Australis Oscar broadcast.
As I said, I had this idea that, you know, after all this time, is it going to work? What happens if it doesn't? What damn fools will seem to be.
T-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff.
Liftoff.
We were waiting and waiting, and we knew it must have been almost overhead, and we, you know, nobody had heard it yet.
Everything's okay. Telemetry signals are all reading nominally. DJ4ZC has tracked the satellite on 29.45.
And suddenly, out of the static, did it. And it was there. It was working.
WI carrying a transmission of the Australis Oscar 5 project. It's now a project. It's no longer a launch. It's successful.
You know, all this pent-up sort of excitement that had been building up for years. Suddenly, it was in orbit. It was working. It was amazing. It's succeeded. We'd done it.
I think back now is when I was a child, I used to have toy rockets and things like that. And now I'm actually getting to put things in the sky. So we got together as a group of students. We initially started just electrical engineering students. And the idea was to build a satellite, which is obviously pretty exciting and pretty engaging, and we had no idea how to do it. When we first started, we didn't know until the first few weeks into it, and we started researching. We're like, hey, like, there's this group, Australis Oscar 5, that did, you know, a similar thing back in the, you know, late 60s, in 1970, they launched it. See, how amazing is it? So we're talking, you know, this, you know, April 1966. Sydney today, the first Australian-built satellite will be launched in the United States at the end of this year. How inspiring. Amazing.
Jan, it's been a long time.
Troy McCann, who's the leader of the group there, contacted me and said, would I like to come along, and some of the Australis group would like to come along and tell them about what we'd done all those years ago.
And it's really interesting every time we talk to someone like Richard Tonkin or anyone from Australis Oscar 5. Yeah, I really do feel like we're carrying the mantle and carrying the torch on.
I hope that they can do what we didn't do, and that is to establish a business for themselves personally so that they've got a career to move into if they want to do that.
Look, I think it's a great idea to have a space industry. I think it's one of a number of industries we should be doing.
Don't be put off. Do it. Follow your heart and do it.
I think Australia has to say, yes, I can do it. I am a big guy too. And put together the organization and just do it.
Oh, what is it about space?
What isn't it about space? You know, it's really magical.
When I look at the night sky, you think just how insignificant we really are.
Well, I think everybody would like to be in space. I would have loved to have been an astronaut. That would have been great. It would have been great fun.
There's a little bit of us, each of us up there, if only from our fingerprints and therefore DNA up there.
I go out past night at night sometimes and look up at the sky and think, it's going over. It's up there. It's still going round the Earth every 100 and something minutes. It's silent, but it's there. Everybody's dancing in the moonlight.
And those beeps from Australis Oscar 5, Australia's second satellite in space, although, as I like to say, the actual first built one. And we're going to be talking again in a few seconds with Richard Tonkin and Peter Hammer, who you heard in that story. But we must thank the Melbourne Space Program for that documentary.
Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
As Charlie Duke said at the beginning of the show, we've got a bunch of guys about to turn blue, at least I am, because I've got in the studio here two of the original members of the Australis Oscar 5 team. That's Peter Hammer and Richard Tonkin. Now, Peter, let's go to a bit of your story. After you left high school, where did you go to?
I went to RMIT and did a diploma. At that stage, you couldn't enter university until you were 18, and I would have had to enter when I was 17, so I did a diploma and skipped first year uni.
Okay, and when you got to Melbourne University, what were you studying?
I studied physics and went on to do an undergraduate degree in physics, but I didn't like physics very much, so it sort of became half electronic engineering. And then I went on and did a PhD at the RAF Academy, which was the research part, was tied up to Melbourne University.
And while you were at university, were you participating in things like the balloon flights and some of the early activities of the
There were two societies there. There was the Astronautical Society and the Radio Society, and I was in the Amateur Radio Society. And yes, we did some stuff, launched little transmitters from balloons and tracked them and had a lot of fun.
Chasing them across the country, I believe.
Yes.
Did you always get them back?
I think we did. We're looking back 55 years, so it's a bit hard to remember.
And how did you get into building Australis then?
Well, I was very much into amateur radio, and we had the Oscars 1, 2, 3 and 4 launched, and even though I couldn't see them because I refused to wear glasses, I still was interested in it. And then we got together with the Astronautical Society and said, well, why don't we build a satellite? We were naive. Nothing was impossible.
I mean, satellites are these things that were built at enormous expense by Americans in America and Russians in Russia. What are you on Earth? A bunch of students. How could you possibly think you could build a satellite here in Melbourne?
Well, it was technology was very much in its infancy in electronics. You were looking at transistor radios. You didn't have all the modern integrated circuits that you have now. In fact, there weren't any integrated circuits. Everything was discrete electronics. And you could do things like that. It wasn't very difficult. We had a good electronics parts manufacturing base in Australia, so a lot of the parts were locally made. Semiconductors were made in Australia by AWA and Fairchild. So it was a different time. You couldn't do it now like that.
Yeah, many people probably don't realize, younger people probably don't realize that we used to make radios and televisions here in Australia.
Oh, we had a thriving electronic industry, which the government very carefully managed to dismantle, like they managed to dismantle for anything to do with technology.
How did you feel about that?
I think it's very sad. I think we've had a series of governments on both persuasions who've got no interest in science and technology, are much more interested in playing politics, and that's not good for the country.
Now, we heard in the documentary there about the trouble of getting it launched. What were you doing during that delay in getting it launched?
I was doing a PhD, and the head of the department wasn't very happy about me spending time on things like satellites. He thought I should be working, doing nothing else but research work. And to be fair, he set an example and did that. He was working flat out on research all the time. So no criticism of him, but I had other things I wanted to do as well.
If people have an idea that students just muck around and do attend protests and so on, but a lot of hard yakka in it, isn't it?
Well, he might have been somewhat jealous because his interest was in high-altitude balloons, and he'd build these massive six-foot-high things to study cosmic rays coming from outer space, and they'd be launched on big balloons from Mildura, and he used to go around the world scrounging balloons and going to one company and see if I get the gas, can you give me a balloon? And then to another company, if I get the balloon, will you give me the gas? And he managed to acquire an awful lot of stuff that way. And they did a very successful program.
The balloons are filled with hydrogen or helium?
Helium.
Much safer than hydrogen.
Yes, but not when you have a premature failure and you lose a whole payload, which might weigh a tonne, up at, say, 60,000 feet.
Ooh. That's one. And did it have a parachute on it to bring it down?
The parachute didn't work.
Ooh, that's a long fall.
They managed to find the charred remains of it.
Okay. Now, what was your feeling when the government at Weapons Research Establishment in Salisbury snuck in ahead of you with this satellite called ReSat?
Well, we weren't very happy about it, but look, I don't think you can really say too much about it. They were testing Redstone rockets. They had the rockets. They just had to throw a bit of a satellite together. And that's what they did.
So this satellite had been delivered to the United States, your satellite, been delivered to the United States in 1967.
Yes.
And ReSat was launched in November of the same year.
We thought we'd get up before ReSat. But it wasn't to be. But we've had the last laugh. ReSat only lasted for about 3 weeks in orbit. Well, we're going to be lasting for 100,000 years.
Yeah, you're still in orbit. We'll come to that later. Now, for the ReSat launch, I understand that you tried to see it, but you had to come back home. Is that right?
No, I don't think I tried to see it. I mean, it was launched from Woomera in South Australia. There'd be no chance of seeing the launch from Victoria.
Oh, I see. The book I've got here, which is called Australis Oscar Five by Owen Mace, led me to believe that you and Richard and Owen, who wrote this book, went to Woomera, and Richard saw the launch.
Yeah.
Right, Richard, come in, please.
Yeah. Well, my recollection is somewhat different to Owen's. What actually happened was that we kept in touch with the people at the Weapons Research Establishment in Salisbury, and they very kindly sent a message over and said, would you like to send somebody over to Adelaide and we can put them on the press plane, which was a DC-3, and we'll fly you over to Woomera for the launch. So the others didn't or couldn't go, and I went over and went over for the launch, and we flew in from Adelaide into Woomera in November, in the middle or the beginning of the Australian summer over the desert, particularly rough ride, and the later editor of The Age, who was sitting next to me in the plane, managed to keep his breakfast down until we actually landed, and then he couldn't control it any further. So we traipsed out to the launch site, I think, in a bus, and they had the countdown, and a very simple rocket, the Redstone, as Peter said, was it was left over from some missile tests, and that was the rocket that had launched the first American satellite, Explorer 1, and had put Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom into their suborbital Mercury flights. Pushed the button, nothing happened, so we traipsed back to the plane and back to Adelaide and came back the next day and pushed the button and it went off. And I was over at Woomera in September 2017, a couple of years ago, when the International Astronautical Congress was on, and we had a trip out to Woomera, and they took us out to the launch site. There are four bolts, large bolts in the ground, nothing else. There's no memorial, there's nothing. You would not know. There isn't even a plaque to show that that's where it was launched from, which is a shame. And hopefully the new space agency, which was established about then, will do something about marking that very historic moment.
Of course, you could understand the plaque's not there because the public aren't allowed into the Woomera range, are they?
Well, we were public and we had to hand in our mobile phones at the airport, but they were happy to take us out. You have to go out under the Air Force's supervision because there are some areas that are still restricted, but it is a shame that that there's been nothing done about it.
Well, I was in Woomera in 1972, I think, and I was working at La Trobe University, and we just went out there. There was no problem about going out there. We were going to see these fighter rockets that we could see a rocket taking off, but it was only a high-altitude sounding rocket. The interesting thing is the Redstone was basically a German V-2, and that was developed by Wernher von Braun. And the coincidence is that my mother had actually met Wernher von Braun when she was living in Germany. So the world's full of coincidences.
Strange but true. So RESAT got into space, and still some time before Australis got approval for launch.
Yeah, the problem was, or the story that we were told, was that the United States Air Force, which had launched the first four Oscar satellites as secondary payloads on military rockets, they classified their space program in late 1967, just after we took their satellite over there. So basically Project Oscar effectively folded because they couldn't get any more launches, and there was a hiatus of about 2.5 years then until late 1969, when an amateur radio group based at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland on the other side of the country, they got interested in the possibility of this satellite, which was sitting in a garage in California in San Francisco, of using that satellite as their first amateur radio satellite with this new group called AMSAT. And Jan King, who was on that piece that you played a few minutes ago, Andrew, he was a young engineer on the Delta rocket program at Goddard, and he really persuaded NASA with some of his young colleagues to find a rocket to put our satellite up with, and it went up on the 23rd of January 1970.
And you've got a special instruction to our listeners.
I have indeed. Thank you for the opportunity, Andrew. At 9:31 tomorrow night, Eastern Daylight Time, please go out into the garden and look up. You won't see it. It's too small to see. It's actually coming over, Andrew tells me, about 10 o'clock tomorrow night. But 9:31 was the launch. So 9:31 tomorrow, Thursday night, Eastern Time, is the 50th anniversary exactly of the launch of our satellite.
Well, we'll do that, won't we?
Absolutely.
So once again, the time to go out is?
9:31 Eastern Daylight Time.
Tomorrow. And tomorrow, Thursday?
Yes, Thursday.
Or is it Friday, you said?
No, it's Thursday night.
It's Thursday night.
The 23rd, right. Yeah.
Yep. And it is actually coming over Melbourne tonight.
That's right, yeah.
But you won't be able to see it.
Yeah, yeah.
And the time is coming over tonight is at about 10 o'clock.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going to come over our horizon at 9:50 and disappear over the other horizon at 9:10.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's so high and it's so small that, unfortunately, you can't see it.
1,450 kilometres, which is why, as Peter says, it's going to last, they tell us, 100,000 years. And it went up with the weather satellite, and the orbit was determined by what the Weather Bureau wanted the weather satellite put into. It's what's called a polar retrograde sun synchronous orbit. So it basically comes over at the same local time every day. So it was a mid-evening satellite with infrared sensors, the weather satellite, and that's why it's coming over about 10 o'clock tonight. Yeah, yeah.
Now, just quickly before we come back to the weather satellite aspect, to give you an idea of how quickly these satellites go around the Earth, coming over at Melbourne 10 o'clock tonight, and then it's coming over again at 6 minutes or 7 minutes to midnight.
Yeah, yeah.
And then again at 1:45 tomorrow morning.
Yep, yep.
And then again at 8:58 tomorrow morning. Then again at 10:50 tomorrow morning. And getting back to the anniversary at 10:55.
Yep, yep.
Is tomorrow night. Yep. It'll come over again. So it, when I say over Melbourne, it's within sight of Melbourne. It's not directly overhead necessarily. Now, strange you should say that this satellite of yours was launched with a weather satellite.
Yeah.
Because your group was involved in receiving pictures from weather satellites. Tell us about that, please.
That's how we started, how the organisation, the Amateur Radio Club and the Astronautical Society decided that we wanted to do something practical. So we built a single helix antenna. The satellites, the American satellites, were mostly operating on 136 megahertz. Then we built a quad helix antenna, which was remotely controlled from a small room in the physics building at Melbourne University. And that was a pretty large unit. We reckon we tracked one of the Russian moon probes to almost to the moon with that antenna. And so we were picking up pictures from the early American weather satellites, and that's what that was the interest that both the groups had in electronics and in space, if you like. And so after we'd done that for a while and found out that we could do it successfully, as Peter said, Owen said on the tape, he thought it was him. I reckon it was me, and Peter thought it was him. It doesn't matter. So somebody said, okay, been there, done that, what do we do next? And somebody said, why don't we build a satellite? And you mentioned before about, you know, students going to demonstrations and marching and doing extracurricular stuff. This was our sort of extracurricular stuff. We didn't do demos and we didn't do marches, and we built a satellite. And we were in our early 20s, and you know, people kept saying you can't do it. And at that age, you know, you're going to live forever, and nothing's impossible. And the more they told us we couldn't do it, the more determined we were to actually do it, and we did.
Yeah, well done. Well, we're talking with Peter and Richard, and we'll be back with them after these messages.
From Sandringham to South Yarra, you're listening to Southern FM.
Well, we are in conversation with Richard Tonkin and Peter Hammer, and they had the unique experience of building a satellite right here in Melbourne. And what a time it must have been. Okay, so the satellite was launched 50 years ago, which is what we're celebrating tonight. And it's in space. But still, do you know it's there? What happens next?
Well, you know it's there because you just told us all the times it's coming over. You've worked out it's certainly still there, yes.
No, but I mean, you're sitting there. You've heard from America that it's been launched, but is it in orbit? Is it going to work?
Yeah, sure. Peter?
Well, it did work. We heard it come over the horizon. Everything was working on it. We had one minor problem, and that was that the VHF transmitter was desensitizing the receiver. So we were having trouble getting commanding the thing. So Liz Jenkins, who was working for CSIRO at the time and had built the command receiver, knocked together this super high-powered transmitter, which was many, many times the legal power limit, and by sheer brute force, we managed to command the thing properly.
Well, I think the statute of limitations has passed and they can't do anything about it.
He's dead.
And
he's no longer with us.
He's a silent king, he's no longer with us here. But in fact, the command receiver, which turned the HF transmitter on and off, we had it on at weekends when most amateurs were active, because it was drawing a lot more power than the VHF one. And the receiver just became more and more deaf, and we had to shout at it louder, if you like.
Yes.
And unlike most satellites these days, or even then, your satellite was battery powered.
Yes, it was battery powered.
So that limited the transmitting life?
It lasted for about 3 weeks.
About 3 weeks, which is about the time that RESAT lasted.
That's the time RESAT lasted in orbit.
Yes.
I don't know how long the RESAT operated for.
I think RESAT was a few days, yeah.
Yes. Okay, so you even did better on transmitting than RESAT, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, solar cells were still very expensive over here, and we certainly couldn't afford them, and I don't know that we had the technology, the technical skill to be able to wire them all up and so on. Peter probably could have done it, couldn't you, Peter?
Possibly.
Okay, and to listen to it, you had to listen in on 29 megahertz or 144 megahertz.
Well, I think 145.7 or something, and 29.45 if you want to be exact. But yes.
Right. And not everyone would have that sort of equipment at home?
No. A lot of amateurs would have had the HF side of things, but the VHF stuff was a bit more less common.
Yes. In fact, I remember when Sputnik 1 was put up, they deliberately broadcast on 20 megahertz because almost everyone in the world in those days had a shortwave radio and could listen in.
And they also transmitted on twice that frequency, didn't they? They had a
40 megahertz.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, had two transmitters. Yeah, that's right. So everyone could listen to it. Yeah.
And did people around the world listen, or just you guys?
Oh yes, well, we had a reporting system that we'd set up, and we had coordinators around the world, and we had a mission operations plan or user's guide as to how to decode the telemetry, and we got hundreds of, if not thousands, of reports that came in from amateur operators all over the world. Yeah.
Well, that satellite's built. It's now in space. What do you guys do next? Build another one?
Well,
I went back to my long delayed law course.
I got involved with two more satellites, Oscar six and seven, and I built the command system for Oscar six and the radio teletype system for Oscar seven. And that was interesting because that was built with brand new CMOS logic, which my university lecturer had said would never ever take off, and all the experts said, "Oh, this stuff will already work for 6 months, if you're lucky." Well, that satellite is still working. It's clocking up, I think it's 46 years in space now, and it's now got the record for the longest operating satellite in Earth orbit. It'll probably keep that forever.
And your professor certainly was proven wrong.
Well, I was out of there. I was working at Latrobe University that time, and I think they were a bit more, and they were doing upper atmosphere physics stuff, and I think they were a bit more accommodating about this sort of thing.
Yes. And we should point out that we're talking about Oscar here. We're not talking about those events in the Hollywood movies. We're talking about orbiting satellite carrying amateur radio.
Yes.
OSCAR.
That's right.
And these satellites are being built by amateurs all around the world.
Oh, yes. It's blossomed since our time. We were only the fifth. I think we were talking before, Andrew, and I think you said that there's been over 100 of the Oscar AMSAT series launched, but there are also a lot of other amateur satellites that don't that aren't connected with that American organisation, from the China and India, Russia, almost every country that builds satellites now has had amateur radio satellites launched.
A few statistics here. There's actually 106 satellites officially Oscar have been launched, but as you said, many, many others with other names not associated with that. And you started a trend, I believe. Oscar 1, which is called Oscar 1, Oscar 2, Oscar 2, 3, was Oscar 3, Oscar 4, but you started a new trend by calling it instead
Australis Oscar.
Australis.
Because we wanted the fact that it was made in Australia to be recognised, and we'd had to do a bit of negotiating with our American friends to get them to not just call it Oscar 5, but to call it Australis Oscar 5.
And all those other satellites, 106 in the Oscar series now, have all, since your satellite, had a prefix, either the name of the country or the name of the organisation.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
The one that you worked on, Peter, I think was called AMSAT
Oscar 6 and 7, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, having built the satellite and, you know, you start going to different areas, you went into a career in law, Richard.
Yeah, I decided that I'd better pick up my long-delayed law course, and I never had a physics or a science brain, and so I wasn't able to do anything the way Peter and the others did in physics and science and engineering and so on. So I plotted back to the law course and went on and became a lawyer.
Lots of photos of you in this book by Owen Mace, a book called Australis Oscar 5, of you pointing antennae and things like that.
filling up balloons with gas bottles and things. Yes, I was fascinated by it, and it just grabbed me, and I was just thoroughly enjoyed doing it. It was my whole life for 2 or 3 years.
And the law, well, actually, towards the end of your career in the law, you got interested in space again.
Oh well, I've always been interested, and in, I suppose, and I decided that I wanted to pursue it as a sort of a more of a travel hobby, and I went to I organised for myself to go to launches in a number of places around the world. Initially in Kazakhstan, in what was then what had been the Soviet Union, to see a manned Soyuz launch with an American group, and then I went to.
This was just after the Soviet Union had disintegrated.
Yes, about
1992 or thereabouts.
92 exactly.
93,
and
yes.
And the Russians were very anxious for some to get some foreign currency, and the Baikonur launch site in Kazakhstan had been a very closely guarded state secret. They didn't want anyone to know where the launch site was, and they even named another town, I think, in Kazakhstan.
Tayaratam.
That's right, yeah. Mm. So, and I went to French Guiana and saw a European launch, and, you know, that was just me. I just wanted to do it, and I enjoyed watching the launches and being involved with the launch teams.
And you've also got an interest in classic cars, I understand.
Yes, I'm permitted by my wife to have three. There is a limit on how many I can have. English cars of the 1950s and 60s, yeah.
Okay, so if you see another one, you've got to sort of sell one off, do you?
Well, we had a situation for a while where she got a new kitchen and I got another car, and then we got the bathroom renovated and I got another car, but I ran out of things to do in the house, unfortunately.
So you couldn't trade it off. Okay, Richard, I'm talking about Owen's book. Peter, what happened to you and your career? You went to La Trobe University.
I did my PhD, then went to La Trobe University, mm-hmm. where I was working in the physics department, and I was building equipment for postgraduate students by and large because I had lost interest in research. And then I got fed up with that and left there in 94 and went into a small company which we'd started off doing air conditioning controls for commercial buildings. And we had a good client list. We had virtually all of Qantas, Austin Hospital, lots of regional hospitals in Victoria and a lot of other big buildings. And I did that until 2010, and then I just lost interest in that and retired. But my other interest has been photography, and I've been doing a lot of that. And I got involved with the camera club in 2005 and started entering competitions, and I've got something like 2,500 acceptances in international competitions and over 200 international awards. So I have a lot of fun doing that sort of thing.
Where did your interest in photography begin?
My mother was an industrial chemist and she'd always been interested in photography, and I just picked it up from her when I was before my teens even. I had a camera.
Well, let's wrap up with a few closing comments from each of you. Where do you think Australia's gone wrong or right over the last 50 years in relation to space?
Well, it took 60 years from the launch of Sputnik almost to the day before an Australian space agency was established. It's now been established. It's small with a staff of 19 plus the head of the agency. But it's very enthusiastic, and hopefully if the government is prepared to fund it properly, it may be able to provide the seed funding to get an Australian space industry going. I mean, those two NBN satellites that were launched over the last two or three years, they call SkyMuster. They're the ones that are used in the outback for the NBN, where there's no cables and available or microwave. They were built in America, I think, and launched by a European rocket from South America. Now, we should have been able to with this, as Peter said, this technology that we've had over the decades. If we've kept that going, we should have been able to build those satellites at huge savings. They're hundreds of millions of dollars each, mm-hmm. and the skills that are built up by the people who were involved in this and building them and so on, rather than exporting, having people doing degrees and so on and then going overseas to work in these industries. So then we need to have a modest space program, and we need to have a robust space industry.
It's interesting that the same rocket that carried one of those SkyMusters had an Argentine satellite that was built in Argentina.
Oh, yes, indeed, yes.
Mm. Peter, what are your views on where we've gone?
I think we've had, over the decades, We've had governments which have had no real interest in science. We even had a government at one stage recently which didn't even have a science minister. It's been a total and utter neglect of technology in this country. What's been done has been done by private companies, and I think the government is really should be, all governments should be held accountable for ignoring science and technology. We can't keep living on primary production. I mean, the world's going to stop buying our coal, and that's going to put a big hole in our budget. And what have we got to replace it with? Tourism? Well, the tourist industry has just had a big nosedive because of climate change. And I think there's, if we'd had, and we did have a really good scientific and technological industry, we'd have other sorts of opportunities for people to get work and become prosperous.
Well, gentlemen, I hope that you enjoy your anniversary tomorrow. And go out, and listeners, please do go out and have a look up and think that 50 years ago, at that very moment, Australia put its second satellite into space. And it was built right here in Melbourne by a bunch of, can I call you amateurs?
Yes.
Absolutely, yes.
Absolutely, right.
We had no idea what we were doing. We just did it.
Yep.
That's sometimes the best way to do things. We've been talking with Peter Hammer and Richard Tonkin from the group at Melbourne University that built the Australis Oscar 5 satellite. Well, we're here to go out now towards Nick Black and Purple Haze with a little bit of Vangelis.